Like that was some of the evidence in our hearing, even though there are numerous other examples that all grad students can think of where, grad students are treated as workers, underpaid, have like unreasonable expectations, etc. Unfortunately, like the specific evidence that was presented differed between the two hearings as well. So that probably played a role. In the TSSU decision, their vice chair who made the decision acknowledged more how the nature of the relationship between grad students and their supervisors is like an employer-employee relationship and has a lot of hallmarks of those types of relationships. And then I think just use that more to support their argument. Whereas our vice chair in our hearing kind of recognized the power dynamic in that relationship, but did not really do anything with that.
Yeah, I wasn't really clear the how the process of decision making happened in our case, compared to the TSSU decision. A lot, again, a lot of the analysis was lacking, and it wasn't clear, how did this person take these two arguments, weigh them together, and come to the conclusion? And we're not convinced that sufficient analysis was given to that.
I know that you said that you've applied for reconsideration at this point, but what would you be able to provide sort of a timeline of what that would look like?
I mean, unfortunately, the labor board is underfunded still. We don't have any clear timeline from them at the moment, I believe, but our expectations based on like our lawyer's opinion and past experience is that it'll still be like quite a long wait. I mean, maybe on the scale of a few months for this decision, but then what comes next? There's a question of like if they'll just decide, yes, we'll reconsider this, and then they have to assemble another panel to like reconsider it. The question of like how much more information, submissions, witnesses they would ask for in that case. Originally, when UBC objected to our application to unionize, there was the objection that we're not workers, which is what the decision was about. And then they had a secondary objection about the bargaining unit being like inappropriate for that group of workers. And since our decision sided with UBC on the first objection, they never addressed the second one. So then there's also a question of if that would be addressed in the reconsideration and if that would take more time. And I think ultimately in all of, or in some of these paths, there's also a chance that we would simply have to reorganize and sign cards again, which would then take even more time.
Is it possible that now that the TSSU's decision has been finalized and they were, I guess, successful in their appeal, does that inspire some confidence for like the next round of argument or bargaining for this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was very exciting to see that decision come out. I think, after waiting 2 years and getting a decision that, says that you're not a worker and you can't have the right to join a union, that's, pretty demoralizing. And I think, hearing the news from the TSSU decision gives a lot of folks maybe more hope that that's something that's possible here in the future. I think that it also kind of provides a framework for how these arguments can be made in the labor board and the types of reasoning that can get a bureaucratic body like that to the conclusion that a group of maybe non-traditional workers like research assistants deserves the same rights as any other worker in the province. But in terms of the legal process itself, it's a little bit complicated and doesn't necessarily like set a legal precedent because of the way that the labor board works as this kind of like a separate body that's not part of the court system and it's got its own, judicial proceedings. We can't necessarily just go and say, look at TSSU decision, that's precedent, and that's why our case should be decided the same way. It's a little bit more roundabout than that.
Yeah, I think it's definitely helpful. Like, it's better than having a bad TSU decision, but hard to say realistically how much that will help. So we've also been, because of these long timelines, have been trying to pursue at the same time a strategy of trying to change the wording of the labor code to have a more expansive definition of employee through lobbying. Primarily so far. So
Okay.
hopefully having this like two-pronged approach, something will happen faster.
One question I had also had for both of you, and this sort of ties to the conversation that I had previously with the TSSU, but even in the case of the TSSU, SFU, the institution, has tried to appeal that decision, and I'd imagine that this time around UBC isn't going to be any more favorable towards the idea of GRAs being able to unionize. Is there any realm of possibility or that you can see in the future of being able to work with the institution in that sort of way? Is there any way that you could foresee UBC or SFU or any university institution in the future seeing the benefit of considering GRAs as employees under the Labor Relations Board?
Do you mean like, sorry, I'm just thinking about how before the SFU unionizing drive, the TSSU drive, that SFU actually voluntarily recognized GSRAs as workers and then withdrew that later. I'm not really sure why SFU did that in the first place.
Yeah, so that what we're kind of referring to, if you haven't heard of that, is the reason why the SFU drive started in 2019 and took so long is that initially there was kind of like a first round of organizing, and then the university was like, "Yay, we're gonna recognize you as research assistants," and it's like, "Oh, this is a great win," until. The TSSU got to the bargaining table, and the university starts being like, okay, well, these ones aren't part of it, and these people are actually not part of the union. And so I think, in that sense, generally, whether or not the employer is going to say that people are workers, we need to have a little bit more backing than that. And so having a legal certification that's granted by the labor board gives us a stronger footing. Once that happens, right? Like once the labor board determines that, these group of workers are part of the union, it doesn't really matter whether the employer is like amenable to it or not, because then there's a legal framework where they're actually legally required to come and sit down at the table and negotiate for working conditions and wages and benefits for that group of workers. So that's kind of the situation. Based on what we've seen with UBC, it seems that they are fully set on depriving graduate research assistants of their fundamental rights as workers, and maintaining a sort of a very extractive relationship where that puts research assistants in really precarious situations, both financially and also with working conditions where a lot of grad students are working, 60, 70 hours a week, working long nights and weekends to get their research done for their supervisor and have no avenue to address a harmful relationship with their supervisor. All of these things are a result of the structural position of graduate research assistants as this kind of quasi-student worker combo where we are producing value for the university, but we're still qualified as students.
Yeah, I don't really see at this point in time a scenario where UBC really like gets on the same page as us, that they would have to be forced to by the labor board. Because we also, at the same time that we filed for graduate research assistants, we also filed for another group of workers, graduate academic assistants, that were like accepted with no objections. And our experience trying to negotiate about this new group of workers has not been great. from the university side.
Yeah, it's generally in the employer's best interest to prevent workers from unionizing because, having a union means that workers can collectively exert power and democracy in the workplace, which kind of, chips away at the employer's ability to exploit people however they want, right?
I think those were the main questions I had, just wanting to know, I guess, where the union was at regarding that decision. But if there's anything, that QB's doing that is upcoming that you want people to know about regarding either the advocacy towards JRA's unionizing or anything of that sort, what would that be?
So around the, research assistant union drive, we're still stuck in this kind of limbo situation where there's not really a clear, like, these are the exact next steps that people can contribute to. But our union is always, working for better working conditions for all of our members on campus. The collective agreement that we have for teaching assistants and other workers within the QP 2278 bargaining unit expired last year. And so our members have been negotiating with the employer for a new contract. And so those negotiations are ongoing. But for all folks on campus, I think this is something that's really important because unionized workers have power in a negotiation when we, as workers together, are informed about what's going on and exerting pressure on the university to for a fair contract. But also, the solidarity of other folks on campus is really important for that. So, if you're an undergrad student, understand that your teaching assistants are fighting for a better contract that not only guarantees better benefits and working conditions for teaching assistants themselves, but we've seen, especially with the recent budget cuts at UBC, kind of a decline in the quality of education over time, with UBC kind of like slashing TA positions and trying to put more work on teaching assistants without giving them extra hours. So those issues are kind of central to our campaign, and it's really important to recognize that the learning conditions here at UBC are the working conditions of QB 2278 members. So what's good for TAs is good for students too. And we're trying to hold central the maintaining an excellent quality of education for students at UBC, which the employer perhaps isn't holding as central to their campaign.
Once again, that was our interview with UBC's QP 2278, the Union for Teaching Support Staff. And you were listening to me speak with Jess Wolf and Drew Hall, the Vice President and President of QP 2278 in the Executive Committee. We are back now with Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM. And before we get on to the next news piece for the hour, I was going to play a little bit more of some local music. This is coming from the band Buddy off of their album from November of last year, I believe, Glass. This one's titled Golden. Once again, you are tuned into Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM. That last track was Golden by Buddy. Next up, we have a piece coming from Nanaimo, BC. This is from fellow LJI journalist Lauren McKenzie, CHLY. And I hope you enjoy.
This is a CHLY news update, highlighting the importance of inclusion in sports. The Nanaimo Clippers hockey team and the Nanaimo Pride Society hosted a Pride Night for the first time. On January 31st, at the Frank Crane Arena, Pride flags flew, and audience members displayed colorful rainbow outfits as they cheered on the home team. The Clippers Junior A hockey team was up against the Coquitlam Express as excitement was filling the arena. Manager of Sales and Business Development for the Nanaimo Clippers, Ricky Thompson, spoke to CHLY right before the puck dropped that night.
We want to really start to bring the community together. We're now in 2026, and it's time for people to be more welcoming of everybody. Everybody could be what they want to be, love who they want to love, and we support that here in Frank Crane. We want to see everybody out here with us.
She says that the Clippers wanted to host this Pride Night because they are proud to be inclusive and are committed to creating a safe and welcoming space.
Yeah, we're ready. Hockey is bigger than just a game. We want to start involving the community more. We are inclusive. We want the people to see that. We want people to come here, feel safe, feel like this is home. This is a fun night out.
Lauren Semble is a president of the Nanaimo Pride Society. She says they're focusing on working with existing community groups to increase visibility and representation for the 2SLGBTQIA+ people in those spaces. They aim to introduce their community members to spaces that might not have always seemed welcoming and inclusive.
When we start to see the cracks open in what is typically an exclusive culture, and we start to see people step up and say, hey, I'm here, I'm queer, and I want to be counted, I matter. It's like, heck yeah, okay. That's the pride. That's the pride of Pride Night, is like, we're getting into this. We are going to be there and be visible and show folks that we are the athletes of hockey, the coaches, the trainers, the staff members, the season's ticket holders. Like, we are hockey in Nanaimo, just like everyone else is.
Semple says it's important more than ever to keep the momentum of inclusion in sports, primarily men's and professional sports, moving forward. They say hockey has not always been a welcoming space for those in the 2SLGBTQIA+ community. In 2023, the NHL banned players from using Rainbow Pride tape, which was used to encourage inclusion in the sport. The ban was quickly lifted after backlash from players and fans. Semple says the Clippers hosting Pride Nights show that there is no room for hate in Nanaimo.
So a lot of folks that are new to the space, new to Nanaimo perhaps, or just have never been to a hockey game before, have never seen the Clippers play, but also a lot of folks that used to maybe go to hockey or in the past and they haven't been for a while. And so we're welcoming people home, we're welcoming people back, we're welcoming newcomers and kind of saying like, hey, Frank Crane Arena is for you too. The Clippers is your hockey team as well, and come celebrate us, celebrate with us.
For the drag queen sisters, PJ and Vicky Smudge, this was not their first Clippers game. The two are longtime Clippers fans and season ticket holders, but this was their first ever game the two showed up as the Sea Queens. Vicky says everyone has been welcoming to them, showing up as their drag queen personas.
Yeah, both PJ are season ticket holders, so it's kind of nice. It's the first time I've looked so fabulous at a game. Usually I'm just wearing a normal plain jersey and a baseball cap. And so far, I was a little apprehensive, a little nervous, but so far everyone's been incredibly welcoming.
PJ says they have both always known the Clippers as being an inclusive space, and she is excited to showcase that inclusion to the rest of the community.
I don't know that I imagined we'd ever be here in drag, but I always knew that the organization is inclusive, and Nanaimo is a very inclusive society. Vicky and PJ have been involved in a lot of firsts in Nanaimo, and it's great to see.
Along with hosting a photo booth before the puck dropped, the sister drag queen extraordinaires joined the Pride Society on the ice for the ceremonial puck drop and hosted a drag race game during the first intermission. For the Pride Night, a section of the arena was turned into a Pride Zone for community members to all sit together. Tyler Green, a director with the Pride Society, was greeting people at the top of the section.
For myself and many of the people I've talked to, it's their first time out at a Clippers game. So it's a lot of fun, and I'm excited to see how the evening goes.
Green, who was waving around a rainbow fabric fan, told CHY that while they've never attended a game before due to a busy schedule, he was excited to come out for Pride Night.
I'm fairly comfortable myself in a lot of places, so but definitely being a Pride Night, I can definitely dress up and be more myself than I would if I had come to a normal night. And that's my goal, is I dress up so that everyone knows that however they want to dress, however they want to act, that is acceptable and it is praise, not something to hide.
Pride Night also pulled in a large crowd, bringing in an audience of approximately 1,500 people, the third largest crowd of the season. Attending their second ever Clippers game was Karina and Mia Bropre. CHY spoke to them in the Pride Zone during the second intermission. Mia says they wanted to go to a game earlier in the week, but when they heard about the Pride Night event, they made sure to show up for it.
Great, yeah. It's really fun. I love all the events going on.
Karina says it's nice to be a part of the first ever Pride Night.
Yeah, it was great. You know, it's nice to see the support. It's nice to see the community out here and having fun watching the hockey game.
Pride Night finished with a win, the Clippers seeing a 5-3 victory over the Coquitlam Express. So far this season, the Clippers rank as the second highest scoring team overall in their league. The Nanaimo Clippers take on the Prince George Spruce Kings Friday, February 6th at the Frank Green Arena. Puck drops at 7 p.m. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious. Something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday. You heard that right, Monday. From 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Scrolling on social media, you may encounter false or misleading posts that question climate science or cast doubt on climate solutions.
Misinformation and disinformation is a huge barrier to the public when it comes to understanding the scale, scope, and causes of climate change, and it stalls real progress.
So Elise Martin, Manager for Persuasion Research and Campaigns at the Environmental Defense Fund, offers some tips for spotting disinformation. If you're unsure about a post, she recommends asking yourself a few basic questions.
Do you recognize the source that is being quoted in the post? If not, does it reference a source that you can easily find?
If you cannot find a credible source reporting the information, that's a clear warning sign. And if the post appears on social media, she says think about whether or not the person sharing it is actually an expert.
It's very easy when just mindlessly scrolling to like and repost something without taking a second to think, well, hang on, this beauty influencer I follow is not really a scientist.
Taking a moment to check what you read and where it came from can help you separate climate fact from fiction. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
This is Bird Note. For some birds, having the best nest is a key part of attracting a mate. Males of many weaver bird species construct a series of intricately woven nests with which to lure a prospective partner. If a female is dissatisfied with it, though, she doesn't just move on. She tears the nest apart, as if to show her disdain. A male red-winged blackbird can even attract multiple mates if he controls a prime breeding territory, where nests can be built over the water, making them less accessible to predators like raccoons. Adélie penguins construct their nests on mounds of stones, which help guard against flooding. And partners often exchange stone gifts during the course of construction. Unfortunately, stones can be in short supply, which leads to skirmishes within the nesting colony, as stones are stolen and fiercely guarded. No stone, one might say, left unturned. For Bird Note, I'm Wenfei Tong.
All right, we have reached the very end of this hour for Speak Up. I want to thank you all so much for tuning in today on this fine Tuesday morning. And make sure you stay tuned. We have a lot of amazing programming coming your way today at 11 a.m. In exactly 1 minute, we've got Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. Tune in for that if you want a hour long of current events going on, mainly within America. And that is a show that plays Monday to Friday, so there's no shortage of Democracy Now! At 11 a.m. here at CJSF. After that, we got Raccoon City, and then a repeat of Typically Tuesdays at 1 p.m. After that, we've got the group chat with a group of Burnaby high schoolers who are going to be doing their own show. It's got a lot of fun things today. Even later tonight, we've got, you know, Slumber Party. We have Big Coover. Just a lot of amazing live programming here at CJSF, and you don't want to miss it, so make sure you stay tuned. Once again, thank you, and again, Democracy Now! Is coming up in about 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hi,